welcome to the MDS Podcast, the official podcast of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society. I'm Michele Matarazzo, and today we'll be discussing a fascinating paper published on the Movement Disorders Journal titled Parkinson's Linked LRRK2 and GBA1 Mutations Modulate the Peripheral Immune Response to Pseudomonas aeruginosa. In this study, the authors explore how two of the most important genetic forms for Parkinson's disease influence immune response to bacterial stimulation, highlighting a potential link between genetics, environment, and inflammation in Parkinson's. Today, I am very happy that I am joined by one of the corresponding authors of the paper, Rebecca Wallings, researcher from the Indiana University at Indianapolis. Becky, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Michele.
So I'd like to start from the big pictures. This is a complex topic. I think we are just starting to understand a little bit more about these things and about the interplay between neurodegeneration, inflammation, immune response, these kind of things. And there's been a growing interest in the role of immune system in Parkinson's disease over the past years. Now, your study really is in between an intersection between genetics and immunology. Can you tell us what motivated you to explore how LRRK2 and GBA1 mutation affect the immune response, and particularly in the context of exposure to an external agent, a bacteria in this case?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll start off with why LRRK2 and GBA. So for listeners who might not be familiar with these two genetic risk factors associated with Parkinson's disease, we decided to look at LRRK2 and GBA because LRRK2 is the most common familial mutations associated with Parkinson's disease, and GBA is the most common genetic risk factor associated with Parkinson's. And the reason that we wanted to look at these two genetic perturbations in parallel is there's a lot of functional convergence between the two proteins that they encode, and they seem to converge highly in the immune system. Both LRRK2 and the protein that GBA encodes, GCase, are highly expressed in the immune system, myeloid cells in particular. And they also have a highly functional role in lysosomal biology. And we've known as a field that both LRRK2 and GBA modulate lysosomal function, and their mutations can perturb lysosomal function in neurons, but also in the context of immune cells, both inside and outside of the brain. As a lab, this paper in particular was conducted whilst I was still a postdoc with Malu Tanzi. I've since started my own lab, and now she's my colleague, which is very exciting. We were very much interested in the role of the peripheral immune system in Parkinson's disease, as it's been becoming more and more apparent over the last, I would say, two decades, that not only is neuroinflammation causative in Parkinson's disease in the sense that it is not just simply a byproduct of neuronal death and neurodegeneration, but it's actually contributing to the disease. But this inflammation is not confined to the central nervous system. We see systemic inflammation in patients, in our preclinical models, and prior data that we'd accumulated before this paper in collaboration with the University of Sydney in Nicholas Samko's lab, we found that patient PBMCs harboring either these LRRK2 or these GBA1 mutations had these differential responses to stimulations with regards to their immune responses and their lysosomal biology. But in that preliminary data, we were looking at maybe a less physiological immune response, because we were essentially taking these PBMCs from patients, plating them and treating them with various different cytokines, which is a great way to obviously stimulate and activate the immune system. But we wanted to transition to some more arguably physiologically relevant immune stimulants, in the sense that we wanted real-world bacteria, real-world viruses, and understand how do patient immune cells respond to these, because we believed that Parkinson's has a gene by environment interaction with regards to the development of the risk. So we wanted to understand how do these genetic mutations affect the immune response to real world environmental pathogens that people would encounter on a day to day. So why Pseudomonas aeruginosa in particular? For those that might not know what aeruginosa is, it's opportunistic bacteria that is very commonly found in soil and in water. It's also a big source of the infections that people will get in hospitals as well. There is not necessarily epidemiological data linking Parkinson's with this particular bacteria, in the sense that the more you're exposed to it, the more at risk you are for getting Parkinson's. But data from our labs over the last few years, we've found that, especially with the LRRK2 mutations, if you give this Pseudomonas aeruginosa to, say, a LRRK2 knock-in preclinical mouse model of Parkinson's disease, the way that these mice and their immune system handle this bacteria is fundamentally different to the way that, say, a wild-type LRRK6 mouse would respond to these bacteria. So we wanted to understand, okay, do we see these in patients as well?
Well, so that's a lot of information. And so it's really interesting because you've been working, your lab and Dr. Tansi's lab has been working on the immune system by giving the step also in not just looking at the inflammation, but how the immune cells respond to a challenge, an external challenge, and an external challenge that is present in our real world outside, right? So I think that's a very interesting approach. And now, talk me about the background. Let's move to the study itself. Let's talk about the design. So you included patients with LRRK2 mutations, with GBA1 mutation, idiopathic PD, healthy controls. Before we go into the results, could you briefly explain how these groups were selected and what you were aiming to compare across them?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So obviously, these individuals who volunteered to donate their PBMCs for this study were age and sex matched, because we know that there is different immune responses at different ages and different between males versus females as well. These PBMCs in particular were sourced with a Michael J. Fox Foundation funded collaboration with Roy Alcley at the University of Columbia and also Tel Aviv, and Alicia Grigio, who is at Barcelona Clinical Hospital. And these individuals were particularly sourced for a presence of either a LRRK2 mutation or a GBA mutation, or individuals that have Parkinson's disease with no known mutation. Certain exclusion criteria included individuals that had concomitant autoimmune diseases, because obviously that would be a huge confound for our kind of study. And we also had to exclude individuals that were on prescribed anti-inflammatory, anything that would modulate the immune system. We had to exclude them just because obviously that would be a huge confound and inhibit our ability to interpret our data. This paper is really the result of a 6-year-long process of us collaborating with these various different neurologists, providing the patient PBMCs, and us working in collaboration with Nicholas DeZamco at the University of Sydney, where through various different phases of this project, we were optimizing the protocol to biobank these PBMCs, have them cryopreserved, and then them be able to be shipped to either, we were at the University of Florida when this paper was being carried out, or University of Sydney, so that we could then cryo-recover these PBMCs and then do ex vivo assays on them, which has been a rate-limiting step for the field for a relatively long time, that PBMCs don't always cryo-recover very well. You don't really cryo-preserve them very well. Sometimes we had to optimize this protocol in order for us to cryo-recover a high yield and high viability of PBMCs. And that in of itself actually took a couple years to get it right and make sure that we could run these assays in parallel across two different institutes and make sure that we were able to see the same phenotypes. We were able to replicate each other's findings. So this paper really was a labor of love.
Yeah. Now, before going into the findings, what did you expect? And mainly, maybe the question is, did you expect to have the same results between LRRK2 and GBA, or any difference that you already thought that you might be there?
Yeah, that's a really good question. For context, with these PBMCs, we plated them and then we treated them either with a vehicle of Pseudomonas aeruginosa, but then we also co-treated with different compounds that will target either the LRRK2 kinase domain or a certain compound that is known to increase GCase activity, because with these GBA mutations, you have a decrease in the GCase enzymatic activity that the GBA gene encodes. So one, with regards to these different treatments, whatever phenotypes we observe, we thought that these treatments would obviously ameliorate them. And what we were expecting to observe has been reported in previous papers. Matt Lavoie's group, who's still at the University of Florida, is one of the groups that's reported this, that shows that LRRK2 mutations are able to modulate GCase activity. So individuals that don't have GBA1 mutations but have a LRRK2 mutation, it seems that there is altered GCase activity as well in these individuals. So there's definitely some kind of convergence and kind of crosstalk between these two proteins, specifically at the lysosome. So we were fully anticipating that the treatments of these drugs would ameliorate phenotypes in the different patient groups as well.
Okay. And before we actually get into results, I'm staying a little bit on the methods here because it's very interesting. One of the things that I saw is all the LRRK2 were the same mutation, the G2019S, while in GBA1 there were different types of mutation. Do you think that implies some variability also because those different mutations don't suppress the GKase activity at the same level?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head, absolutely. So like you said, with the LRRK2 mutations, we were able to have all G2019S carriers. It is the more common mutation out of all the LRRK2 mutations, so it made sense for us to be able to have a lot of G2019S. Unfortunately, when you're working with patient populations, you have to work with what you have. And it would have been wonderful if we could have either stratified the GBA patients based on their specific GBA mutation, because you're right, these GBA mutations do decrease GKase activity at different rates. And we did see a lot of variability in our GBA patients. And we do think it is driven primarily because of their different GBA mutations. But unfortunately, just with the N that we had of these patients, we weren't powered enough to stratify by mutation. Absolutely, ongoing research is going to be looking at that because we want to understand. A big focus of both mine and Malou's lab is trying to understand how these different immune responses could be contributing to the heterogeneity that we observe in Parkinson's disease in a clinical sense, in the pathological sense as well. So we absolutely do want to understand what these different mutations are doing because we believe that there's going to be different responses, especially in the immune system, for sure.
Okay, we look forward to further studies published by you and your group. Now, let's go to the results of this one. What happened when you looked at GBA1 mutation and immune response?
I will try and keep it brief and to the highlights, because I'm sure as you went through this paper, there's a lot of findings. We have various different groups, various different treatments, various different immune cell types we're looking at, different readouts. It's a very results-dense paper. So I'll keep it to the highlights. One of the things that we found that was one of the less surprising observations, in particular the GBA Parkinson's PBMCs, when we treated them with the Pseudomonas aeruginosa, they increased secretion of cytokines into the medium. So they had a increased inflammatory response to the Pseudomonas aeruginosa. That wasn't the most surprising thing we observed, because there's a lot of literature to suggest that there is an increased pro-inflammatory response in Parkinson's disease. There's increased inflammation. It could be contributing to the neuroinflammation and subsequent neurodegeneration that we observe in the brain. So that wasn't too surprising. What was somewhat more surprising is that we didn't observe too many cytokine secretion phenotypes in the LRRK2 patients. In fact, in some of the cytokines, so with TNF and IL-10, there was actually almost a decrease in the response that LRRK2s were actually secreting with their cytokines, which maybe I'll talk about that afterwards when you ask about the implications of these findings. So it seems like that the LRRK2 and the GBA were responding very differently, which in of itself was somewhat surprising given the fact that we know that LRRK2 and GBA converge on very similar pathways, but they seem to not be responding the exact same way, at least to Pseudomonas aeruginosa. So that in of itself was very interesting. What was also a very unsurprising result was the compound that we were using to increase GKase activity didn't really actually seem to do much to the GBA patients. We saw these altered cytokine responses. We saw some altered GBA-dependent phosphoRAB10, which is a kinase substrate of LRRK2. So it seems like GBA is altering LRRK2 activity somehow in these immune cells. But when we hit them with the GKase activator, we didn't really see that much of a response. And one of the things that we discussed about why this could be happening is that there could potentially be a compensatory response from other lysosomal enzymes to counteract the fact that there is lysosomal dysfunction caused by this GKase activity. And then by activating GKase, you almost hit a ceiling effect, that the lysosomes have already started to compensate and keep themselves happier. So the presence of this GKase activator doesn't really do that much. But what was really interesting is that when we took the LRRK2 mutation, the LRRK2 mutant PBMCs, and we treated them with the GKase activator, we actually saw a fair amount of different responses. We saw increase in MHC2 expression on the plasma membrane of different monocyte subtypes. And for those of listeners that might not know about MHC2, is the mouse gene, but HLA-DR in human, it's antigen-presenting complex that's presented on antigen-presenting cells. And we actually saw an increase in this when we treated the LRRK2 mutant carrier PBMCs with this GCase activator. And then we talk about why that might be happening due to the fact that there is lysosomal dysfunction in the LRRK2 patients. The presence of this GCase activator kind of kickstarts that system and allows these different antigens that are being processed in the lysosome that then subsequently get shuttled up to the plasma membrane to be presented to T cells. We think that kind of kickstarts that system. So the fact that we were able to see that in the LRRK2, but the GBA almost had this ceiling effect that we weren't able to observe was really interesting because it shows that there's a very complex crosstalk between these two proteins, and especially when they're mutated, that absolutely needs further dissection to understand where they're talking and why hitting LRRK2 with GCase activators does one thing, but it doesn't do that to GBA mutations that have less GCase. It was an odd observation, and we're still scratching our head over.
Yeah, I think this opens the field to new ideas and new hypotheses that will launch new projects. And actually, you've been very clearly explaining how GBA and LRRK2 are two of the genes that are mostly related with Parkinson's disease. But from a clinical standpoint, they are on an individual level indistinguishable from idiopathic Parkinson's, but on a group level, they do have some differences. And for example, we know that GBA have a different non-motor phenotype. LRRK2, it's basically the opposite from the non-motor point of view. They tend to do a little better. So do you think that these differences that you see from an immune and inflammatory standpoint have anything to do with the phenotype on one hand? And also, not only they're different from the phenomenological point of view, but they're also different if you look at the brain. People with LRRK2, for example, they tend to have less or lower amount of alpha-synuclein aggregation as compared to idiopathic PD or to GBA PD, where the synuclein is supposed to be the main protein aggregated. And if you look at the recent data with alpha-synuclein seeding assay, you will even have a little bit higher number than idiopathic Parkinson's disease in GBA mutated people. So do you think the pathological and the phenomenology have anything to do here with what we see in the immune response?
Absolutely. Obviously, right now, everything that I'm about to say is a hypothesis, it's speculative, obviously. So another paper, the first author of this paper was Dr. Julian Mark, who at the time was an MD PhD student in Malou's lab, who I had the honor of supervising as I was a postdoc with her. He had another paper that came out a little bit earlier than this paper. We didn't have any LRRK2 or GBA mutations in this paper. We had idiopathic Parkinson's patients, as well as individuals that had RBD, so REM behavioral sleep disorder, as a kind of prodromal group, and then neurologically healthy controls. And we did a similar kind of experimental paradigm in this experiment. In particular, we weren't using a bacteria, we were using cytokines to stimulate the immune system. But what Julian did is he stratified the individuals that had Parkinson's, he stratified them based on whether they had early Parkinson's, so they'd been diagnosed within the last 5 years, or if they had what we were referring to as moderate Parkinson's disease, so they'd had Parkinson's for 10 plus years. So they were just at a different stage of clinical progression. And what he found is, at least with the way that these immune cells were secreting cytokines, is there was a really nice correlation between the amount of cytokines that were being produced and these individuals' UPDRS scores. So it seemed like the more immune dysfunction that was being present, the more motor clinical symptoms that these individuals were presenting. And is that driven by differences in the immune system itself, or is it just because they are slightly different ages? Because obviously the individuals that were in the moderate Parkinson's disease were slightly older. Obviously they're the ones that had early Parkinson's disease. Was it a byproduct of just motor progression and neurodegeneration and increased disease progression kind of feeding back onto the immune system? We're still not entirely sure, but it does seem that alterations in the immune response does have some kind of correlation with these clinical phenotypes that we observe. And we absolutely think that this will also be the case when we look at different patient mutations as well. So if we have individuals that have GBA, LRRK2 mutations, we absolutely anticipate that we will see very different immune responses based on genetic status, disease status. And one of the other projects that we're going to be starting in the next few months in my lab is we're trying to understand how markers of an aging immune system. An aging immune system sounds like a wishy-washy way of describing it, but essentially we're very interested in immunosenescence and immune cell exhaustion, and this idea that there's a suppressed immune response occurring in certain patients. And we're going to be looking at these phenotypes in different LRRK2 mutations, GBA mutations, idiopathic Parkinson's disease, males versus females, to try and understand how these different immune phenotypes correlate with clinical and pathological progression as well, to understand how it contributes to this heterogeneity.
Okay, so a lot of work going on. Now, one of the things, the results you show that genetic mutation also shape how the immune system responds to a pathogen. What do you think this tells us about the role of infections or environmental exposures in Parkinson's?
I think it shows that there is absolutely a gene by environment interaction, especially when it comes to the immune system in Parkinson's disease. I think LRRK2 is a really great example to really emphasize that point, where we know that LRRK2 mutations are not 100% penetrant. And we know that LRRK2 mutations are also associated with various different infections and other inflammatory associated diseases, such as Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. It's been very well studied in the field of tuberculosis. We know that LRRK2 is functionally responsible for immune responses and responses to different infections. And I think that in of itself is a huge piece of evidence to suggest that there is a role of infections and these kind of environmental inflammatory triggers in Parkinson's disease. But as well, I think if we just look at the epidemiological data, like the Spanish flu, for example, where we see when that was occurring, there was a huge uptick in individuals diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in the subsequent years, suggesting that the exposure to chronic infections and subsequent chronic inflammation really does predispose individuals who are already at risk, potentially genetically, for Parkinson's disease to then cross over that threshold to develop Parkinson's disease and get that clinical diagnosis.
Great. Now, looking forward, you already have unveiled some of the projects you're working on for the future. But what would you say are the next key questions that need to be addressed following this work?
No, absolutely. One of the things that my lab and Malu's lab as well are most focused on is how do we target the immune system, and also in who, and also when as well. I mentioned one of Julian's other papers where we looked at individuals who have RBD and compared them to individuals that have early or moderate Parkinson's disease. And what we observed was so interesting, and it really changed the way that I look at inflammation in Parkinson's disease. What we found is that individuals that have RBD, they had this kind of hyperinflammatory immune response to different immune activators. But then as you went from RBD and then into looking at the early Parkinson's and moderate Parkinson's individuals and their PBMC immune responses, it almost was this kind of hyperactivation followed by this subsequent suppression in this kind of stepwise manner, where you have this huge activation of the immune system in RBD. But as you go from RBD into early Parkinson's into moderate Parkinson's, it becomes more and more suppressed. And that was very surprising, because we think a lot of the field views inflammation as something that is hyperactive, it is increased, it's something that needs to be suppressed, it needs to be quashed, which is why a lot of the clinical therapies that have made it to phase two clinical trials have taken this kind of suppressant anti-inflammatory approach. But none of those clinical trials have yielded any promising results. And I think, and my hypothesis of my entire lab is, we've been looking at inflammation kind of the wrong way. It seems that in the kind of prodromal years leading up to Parkinson's, yes, there is chronic systemic inflammation happening. There's potentially hyperinflammatory immune responses. But one thing that happens in the human body in the face of chronic inflammation in general, but then if you then combine that with an aging immune system, which naturally does come more suppressed as we age, the immune system will adapt. It will always try and modify its own responses in order to stop damaging the host, because that's its priority, is that it wants to protect the host, right? So if it's bombarded with this chronic inflammation, there's this hyperactivation for years and years, over time, the immune system will adapt and it will compensate by suppressing itself. And a lot of my research as a postdoc with Malu that I'm now working on in my own lab suggests that there actually might be a suppression of the immune system happening in individuals with Parkinson's, which when I say that, some people look at me a little bit funny and say, what do you mean? That's not what the field has been saying for the last 10, 20 years. But it seems like there is an inability of the immune system in individuals with Parkinson's to actually resolve the inflammation, which is the problem. There seems to be this low-grade chronic inflammation at baseline that is just always present. But then if you hit them with an infection, cytokine activation, whatever the immune challenge is, it seems that there's almost an inability to respond and resolve subsequent inflammation, which means that the chronic inflammation just stays there for a long time. So instead of trying to suppress a potentially already suppressed immune system, my lab's approach, and we're trying to understand if this is a therapeutically relevant way of targeting it in Parkinson's, but we actually want to, I'm not going to say activate the immune system, but rejuvenate the immune system, try to bring it back to a state of homeostasis where it is able to respond to immune challenges in a way that it once did when it was a lot younger, I guess is the word to describe it.
So instead of using that hyperinflammation phase as a window to suppress it, is to avoid suppressing it later on.
Yes. So this is when the when do we target it and how do we target it comes into question. So the way that, and this is absolutely an oversimplified way of describing it, but the way that I think about it in my head is if we're thinking about targeting the immune system in individuals who are at risk for Parkinson's, so the prodromal stages, where there is this hyperactivation that's causing this chronic inflammation, in those individuals, it absolutely makes sense to try and suppress the immune system because we want to get rid of that chronic inflammation. But it seems, at least in the context of my research, and right now, most of my research focus has been on LRRK2 mutations, so whether this is relevant to other genetic mutations or idiopathic or sporadic Parkinson's, we're still not quite sure yet. But it seems, at least with the LRRK2 mutations that we've been studying in my lab, it seems that once Parkinson's disease, there's onset and there's clinical symptoms and they've received that diagnosis, it seems that the immune system actually has this kind of suppressive phenotype. So potentially trying to use that suppressant anti-inflammatory approach with those individuals wouldn't be appropriate. We'd have to try an alternative therapy to bring that immune system back to a well-functioning state. I don't want to say increasing the activity because you don't want to increase the activity in an immune system support that is already dysfunctional. Support. There we go. Yes.
Okay. Becky, thank you so much. If you had to pick one message that you want a clinician or researcher interested in this area to take away from your study and your work, what would that be?
I want people to understand that the peripheral immune system is a contributor to Parkinson's disease. So much of our research now suggests that it is systemic inflammation in Parkinson's and other neurodegenerative diseases that is etiologically relevant. It is not just neuroinflammation within the CNS. It is also occurring outside the brain, which I think opens up a whole avenue of potential therapeutic implications. The immune system outside the brain is far easier to target rather than trying to target the immune system within the brain. So if we can try and understand how the peripheral immune system is contributing to these diseases and how we could potentially target it in the context of disease, I think we'll open up a lot more accessible therapies.
Well, Becky, thank you so much for joining me today. It was really a nice discussion on a very relevant and poorly addressed and understood topic, I would say. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Okay, we've been discussed about the paper Parkinson's linked LRRK2 and GBA1 mutations modulate the peripheral immune response to Pseudomonas aeruginosa, published on the Movement Disorders Journal. So I certainly invite you to go and take a look. And thank you all for listening.
If you enjoyed the conversation about this paper, you can further your experience with continuing medical credits or CMEs. You can find the link to the journal CME course for this paper within the episode description on the MDS website. Journal CME is planned and implemented in accordance with the accreditation requirements of the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, ACCME. The International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society is accredited by the ACCME to provide continuing medical education for physicians. The International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society designates this education activity for a maximum of 1 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society or their affiliated journals, Movement Disorders, and Movement Disorders Clinical Practice. Any disclosures of the participants can be found within the episode description located on the MDS website.